dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we're going to look at the battle to defend the human right and human necessity of access to fresh, clean water and the attempt of corporate privatizers to seize hold of it. Whosoever controls your access to water controls you, because you'll die without it. So, of course, this is an important subject for everyone, but it's a critical issue to those of us here in New York State fighting an invasion of gas drillers. In order to access the gas contained in shale thousands of feet below, the drillers must use a process patented by Halliburton called fracking that requires the injection of billions of gallons of a toxic brew of water, sand, and chemicals into the earth to force gas from the shale formations. This practice has already despoiled the Intermountain West and is rapidly ruining the land, water, and lives of people just to the south of me in rural Pennsylvania. The only reason they could use this toxic process was that the Bush-Cheney administration and their pals in Congress put a provision in the 2005 Energy Act exempting these drilling corporations from the Clean Air and Water Act provisions. The reason for doing so should have been obvious, but is now, sadly for those places, all too obvious. These processes poison the air and poison the water. They take clean, fresh water and ruin it. For those of you not in this area, where I live is a land of lakes, rivers, and waterfalls, a paradise of fresh water. A vanishing thing on this planet, as you will hear on the show this week. So-called development has been progressively turning Earth into a desert through its wasteful conduct. Did you know that the Sahara Desert was once a forest? The Romans cut it down to take the wood, so all the topsoil blew away. Iraq was once a fertile crescent, not a blazing desert. Have you ever wondered why the Bible talks of cedars of Lebanon? Yes, there used to be cedars, not desert there. Greece used to have woods and springs. The history of civilization could be described as the history of humans turning earth to desert. The gas drillers are salivating at the prospect of taking all our water and fouling it for use in their profit-making activities, then dumping the polluted mess in the woods when nobody's looking, as they have already done elsewhere. What do they care? They'll trash my home the way they've trashed other people's homes. Fact. That is what they've done. Fact. They trash places and are allowed to do so because corrupt or lazy governments allow them in the name of the sacred economy. Fact. If they had to perform their activities without ruining the land, in economic terms without externalizing the damage for us to bear, their activities would no longer be profitable. You've heard them whining about that, right? So we, and others before us, are to be destroyed so they can make money. That sounds absurd, but that's pretty much the way things have been done in America. Things will go on that way until we put our feet down And among the things you'll hear on the program this week is about people who have put their feet down when it comes to the right to water. Blue Gold is a documentary on the subject of water privatization that was released last year based on a book of the same title by Tony Clark and Maude Barlow. I've adapted it for radio and we'll hear it in a few minutes. For those facing the gas drilling threat, the information in this film adds a whole new dimension. Rural listeners, please bear with me while I explain something for the urban folks who are used to getting their water from a utility and flushing it into a sewer system. In the film, and in the public debate generally, people tend to speak of water service as public versus privatized. But there is a third alternative, which is used by people in rural areas, and that is water as commons. Out here, most people get their water from their own wells and send the wastewater into a septic system. This system cleans the water and returns it back into the ground from whence it came. Water mixed with solid waste goes into a tank that's buried in the ground. The tank is colonized by bacteria that decompose the waste. The liquid then leaches out through a series of perforated pipes that are running underneath the ground. The size of the tank and the length of the pipes is determined by the number of people living on the property and the characteristics of the soil. This is why in rural areas, if people are going to have a very large gathering, they will often rent a port-a-john or invite guests to find a bush in the woods like other critters, because a septic system can only work at a certain flow rate and will overflow if there is an outsized demand placed on it. This has been portrayed as a disadvantage and as a lack of progress, but it's a great advantage to people who want to defend their home from becoming a strip mall fast food disaster area. You cannot operate a McDonald's on a septic tank or a big hotel with hundreds of toilets and showers going. Nor is your water removed from the watershed when you use this sort of a system. The danger of removing water from a watershed will be discussed extensively in the film you'll hear. A person with a well and a septic system pays not a penny to any utility company. And if you pump with solar or wind, you'll never be a slave to them for this critical survival need. You are a very unprofitable individual for the corporations, and they want to stamp you out. The water is in the ground or in the stream, and you are free to use it, so long as you don't do anything to screw it up for the people downstream of you. That's how water as commons works. That's how millions of people in the United States have been getting their water for a very long time. And before there were well pumps and septics, there were buckets, still in use in many parts of the world. Bringing this back to the gas drillers, if they pollute the water as well as extract the gas, there is a great additional profit opportunity. Selling us the water we once had for free as part of the commons they destroyed. And in fact, this is what has happened to many people in rural Pennsylvania and elsewhere whose wells and streams were ruined forever because a plume of gas is now leaching into their aquifer. Some people are actually able to light the water coming out of their tap on fire. You can see the videos on YouTube. And in the film Split Estate, that's going to be screening on the Cornell campus on November 3rd, I'll give you more information about that later so you have a chance to get something to write with. Inquiring minds want to know how many New York State officials involved in making decisions about gas drilling own stock in companies or own shares in funds that deal not only with gas, but with water. And these companies include, as you will hear on the program this week, corporate giants like General Electric, Procter & Gamble, and Dow Chemical. I'm going to see what I can find out. If you happen to know or know anyone who might have this information on hand, please contact me. I am a one-person operation here with a budget of zero. Thanks. The film we're going to hear, Blue Gold, echoes some important concepts that were discussed by Charles Eisenstein in The Ascent of Humanity. That is, taking from us what we once did and once had for free, then selling it back to us. I didn't spend all those months reading The Ascent of Humanity to you just to move on to something else as if it never happened. I read the book to create a common framework of understanding that we can use to evaluate specific situations like gas drilling and the crisis of the Earth's dwindling clean, fresh water, for example. A listener recently sent me a note congratulating me on what he called my courage in contesting what he considered to be a central premise of The Ascent of Humanity, the idea of a purposeful universe. Much as I would like to be courageous, and I appreciate his kind compliment, I feel it's undeserved, because I don't see the question of the purpose of the universe as the central issue of the book. If I thought it were, I wouldn't have even bothered to read the book to you, because as I've said, whether the universe has some purpose or not, whatever that means, is not something I much care about. It is the regime of me and mine, the destruction of community, love, and beauty, and the passionate assertion of our rights to it, and the necessity of it, to living a meaningful life, is for me the core topic of the book. To me, it is about restoring to human beings our stolen birthright, to live freely and harmoniously with nature like other animals, to assert our natural right to food, water, shelter, and companionship that all creatures have, and that all creatures can have, only when we respect equally the birthrights of others. As Gerard Winstanley so eloquently said in 1649, "The earth is a common treasury for everyone to share." The so-called New York State Department of Environmental Conservation has released a draft of its environmental impact statement for public comment through the end of November. By this document, they hope to permit, not stop, gas drilling. Our programs on CELDEF and Democracy School that have aired on this show should have you already well-versed in the failure of that framework to prevent despoilation. This analysis of the document comes from our friends at Catskill Citizens for Safe Energy. The document, which is officially called the Supplemental Generic Environmental Impact Statement Draft, will, when finalized, govern shale gas extraction for years to come in the state. It is 809 pages long and is a detailed and often highly technical document that will require careful study and technical analysis. According to Catskill Citizens, at first glance, it appears to be a mix of the good, the bad, and the ugly. On the positive side, it appears to require mandatory baseline testing for water wells within 1,000 feet of gas wells. 1,000 feet is just nothing. Disclosure of the chemicals used in fracking fluids, yes, because they're trying to keep those a secret. The use of steel containers in floodplains to store toxic fluids. I'm sorry, they ought to be in steel containers no matter where they are. Everything around here is a floodplain. A 1,000-foot buffer for the New York City watershed. Fine, what about my watershed? What about your watershed? Okay, now on the other hand, that was the good. Okay, now here's the bad. Permits gigantic 5-acre open pits containing 16 million gallons of toxic waste piped in from as far as 4 miles away from multiple wells. I don't think so. Fails to address the cumulative impact of thousands of miles of access roads, gas-gathering pipelines, toxic fluid pipelines on our environment and other sectors of our economy. The comment I'd like to make here, I can't even say on the radio, about where these people should take themselves. I don't mean the Catskill Citizens. I mean the New York State DEC. Sometimes the draft seems strangely incomplete, say, the Catskill citizens. For example, there's a single fleeting reference to a process being used in Canada that employs, quote, propane in place of water-based hydraulic fracturing fluids. Does that mean we could avoid the use of toxic fracking fluids altogether? The draft doesn't attempt to answer this all-important question. This flawed and inadequate document, they say, will require extensive revisions if it's going to adequately protect the public. Well, here's to that. Under New York state law, the public has the right to study and comment on the draft, but the 60-day period allowed by the DEC is clearly insufficient for a document of this length and complexity. Additionally, the DEC has refused to hold any hearings to receive public comments. Catskill citizens and Shale Shock, also, and other citizens' groups are asking Governor Patterson and the DEC to accept public comment for 120 days and to hold public hearings throughout the affected areas of the state. The FRAC Act continues to gain support in Congress. In the last 2 weeks, the bill picked up four more co-sponsors in the House, where it now has 29 co-sponsors. And on October 1st, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand became the fifth senator to co-sponsor the bill. If you haven't registered your support for this legislation, please do it now, because it will go a long way toward protecting our drinking water, but not as long as banning hydraulic fracturing from New York State altogether and from anywhere else. For news and information and to get involved here in the Central Finger Lakes, go to shaleshock.org. Okay, now for the November 3rd screening that I referred to earlier for local listeners here in the Finger Lakes. There will be a screening of Split Estate on November 3rd at 7 p.m. on the Cornell campus at the cinema in Uris Hall, with an introduction by someone from Shale Shock. The film deals with Garfield County, Colorado, and what happened with the gas drilling there. The gas drilling boom hit their area with promises of big money and a clean alternative. The reality has been, as they say, far more complicated, with landowners forced to accept drilling rigs right outside their front door, groundwater becoming contaminated, and a host of public health issues, especially illness among children. And their breathtaking panoramas and clear mountain water threatened by an industry that is exempt from federal protections like the Clean Water Act, as I mentioned earlier. In the film, you'll see one resident demonstrate the degree of benzene contamination by setting a stream alight with a match. That's a stream flowing through the land. This cautionary tale should be seen by people here in the Finger Lakes as gas companies prepare for a massive hydrofracking assault on our area. And here's what Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico had to say of the film. Quote, "This film is of value to anyone wrestling with rational, sustainable energy policy while preserving the priceless elements of cultural heritage, private enterprise above ground, and the precious health not only of people but of the land itself." Close quote. And now, our feature presentation. Based on the book Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of Water, a film by Sam Bazo. For Ethan, this is how the world is. It doesn't have to be. Blue Gold, World Water Wars.
In 1906, Pablo Valencia dared the journey from Mexico to California in search of gold. He survived without water for a week, 7 days. He was rescued and documented the experience of thirst. Saliva becomes thick. A lump seems to form in the throat. The tongue swells so large that it squeezes past the jaws. The throat so swollen that breathing becomes difficult, creating a terrifying sense of drowning. The face feels full due to the shrinking of the skin. Many people begin to hallucinate. The eyelids crack, and the eyeballs begin to weep tears of blood. When Pablo Valencia was found, his skin was like purplish-gray leather, scratched but with no traces of blood. His lips had disappeared as if amputated. His nose withered to half its length. His eyes trapped in a winkless stare. This is not a film about saving the environment. It's a film about saving ourselves. Because whatever one's environmental, political, or religious opinions, whatever one's race, sex, or economic standing, whomever of us goes without water for a week cries blood.
Jim Olson, environmental attorney.
There is always a lot of focus on, well, what's the environmental impact? And that's a perfectly valid issue and concern. The abuse of water and the taking of excessive water, diminishing flows and levels, can destroy the sustainability of ecosystems. But we can't, in the name of preventing environmental impacts, there's a mentality that says, well, as long as we're not causing any significant impacts, we should be able to use the water any way we want, including selling it, exporting it for private gain of a few. When it's all said and done, people need water to survive. That's what the bottom line is.
When we search the universe for life, we search for water. Because it is only from liquid water that all known forms of life exist. The Blue Planet. The only planet known to harbor life. The only planet known to be flowing with water. Water management has always been of key importance to humans. The Egyptians depended entirely upon the Nile. The Romans expanded the boundaries of engineering to use gravity to bring water to their cities. Ancient societies cherished water, molded their lives around it, and even worshipped it as a god. For whatever reason, between 800 and 1000 AD, climate change dried up most of the Mayans' local water supply. Farmers were forced to extend their agriculture into the jungle forests to grow food. There was not enough water for both the crops and trees, so the forests died. The soil eroded. Air humidity decreased. Food decreased. Mayan leaders prayed to the god of rain, but the regular rain season brought little water. The hydrologic cycle was damaged. Life in the cities became less civilized, as the main focus of Mayan life became providing food and water. People abandoned the cities to begin a new life in the forests, in hopes that there was still a sustainable watershed there. There wasn't. But as we enter a new era combining high technology with the demands of global economic trade, we're entering into a unique stage of history.
Water, which is the source of life itself, instead of being common and universal to everybody because we all depend on it, profit is made out of the running of and the delivery of water to people and to communities.
Tony Clark, co-author Blue Gold, executive director Polaris Institute.
Those that have the ability to pay will have access to the water. Those who do not have the ability to pay will go without. And therefore, it's a life and death situation in the final analysis on the basis of profit.
The crisis. World Social Forum, Nairobi, Kenya.
Thank you very much, and it's a great honor to be on this stage with you. I want to talk, comrades and friends, about a global water crisis in which we know that the world is actually running out of water.
Maud Barlow, co-author of Blue Gold, national chairperson of the Council of Canadians.
And that wasn't supposed to happen. It wasn't supposed to be able to happen because we were all taught back in, I don't know, grade 3 or 6 or whatever, that there's a cycle.
When it rains, the water falls from the clouds down all the way to the ground. It soaks into the ground and then the grass and trees grow. Sometimes there's so much water underground that lakes and rivers just pop up, like when you squeeze a box of apple juice. The rivers carry the water back to the ocean. Inside the ocean, the water floats up to the sky as clouds again. Then the wind pushes the clouds towards the land and it rains again. This all happens over and over, forever and ever.
97% of the Earth's water is salt water. 3% of the Earth's water is fresh water. Much of that is polluted beyond human use.
How is our water being polluted? Agriculture uses chemicals to increase farming productivity. Ironically, implemented to counter a diminishing water supply, these chemicals pollute the groundwater. Automobile gas emissions pollute the clouds. But perhaps the most damaging culprit is industry. Water pollution has been linked to the rising miscarriage rates in women, lower sperm counts in men, and it is so globally severe that the Malaysian government proposed the death penalty for anyone caught contaminating water.
Border, United States and Mexico.
This is the most polluted river in the United States. There's active polio, tuberculosis, hepatitis. Well, we try and reason with the aliens and, you know, tell them what's in the water and try and get them out.
Agent Barrera's U.S. Border Patrol.
None of the agents are going to get in that water to get any of these aliens. They're just contaminated. We have a gate that we deploy across the river down the ways a little bit, and we'll deploy that gate, and then they'll all pretty much go back into Mexico. We already have a battery of shots that we take here at the local hospital. It's about 18 different shots for if any agent falls in that water to keep from getting contracting something.
Mexico City, Mexico. Octavio Rosas Landa, Centro de Análisis Social Información y Formación Popular.
What we saw today was a river of human sewage. The water smells like nothing you could ever imagine. As much as 25,000 liters per second flow.
Eduardo Hernandez Oles, Mexico City Water Works union organizer. The waste from hospitals, schools, all the waste in the city's sewage system comes through here. Even human remains come through here. The hospital waste, sometimes fetuses, dead dogs.
It goes into the northeast where people grow crops that later on are sold in the Mexico City market. So we are being poisoned. Our wastewater is returning to us in the form of food. When you look into the rivers, you can see bubbles. That means that the rivers are losing oxygen.
Over 60% of the world's wetlands have been destroyed in the past 100 years.
Contamination and pollution of the water systems is creating cholera and water diseases are killing more children today than malaria or AIDS or even wars themselves.
Robert Glennon, author, Water Follies.
In the wetlands would normally have been a process whereby there would have been some cleansing of that taking place. It goes through the wetlands and it comes out more purified into the river systems, etc. But what happens when the wetlands are destroyed, where we poison a certain amount of water that can never really be fully recycled?
What we now know is that we are polluting and depleting this finite stock of fresh water so fast that we're now mining the groundwater faster than it can be replenished.
It rains. The water hits the ground and percolates into the soil, collecting underground into what are known as aquifers or groundwater. But how much of our finite supply of water is underground? We can only estimate, as there is no reliable method to accurately measure, which is why our growing dependency on groundwater is such an urgent concern.
The fabled Atlantis in the Middle East had a real city attached to it. It was called Ubar. It disappeared, and no one could figure out what happened. And then some archaeologists found it. And what they realized is it collapsed into the desert sand from groundwater pumping. Not only could it happen, it is happening today in Florida. Giant sinkholes have emerged, all of a sudden just big cavities in the ground opening up.
The effects are not always evident, as with a sinkhole or lost city. Entire regions can slowly and evenly sink as a watershed is depleted.
Perfect example is where Mexico City is now. There was once an oasis of water. When the Spanish came, they didn't want their new city to look like Venice. They wanted it to look like Madrid. And they used slave labor to cut down all the trees that would protect the water sources and to dredge the water systems. And what happened was that they just destroyed the water table. And of course, that was one thing when there were 10,000 people living there. It's another when there are, what, maybe 25 million. They've taken the rest of the water underneath the city. The city is literally sinking in on itself, and these great big churches are beginning to, you know, go sideways. And Mexico is having to go further and further and further away from its local water sources, because there aren't any left, to find water.
Human ingenuity has found out ways to get water from beneath the surface of the earth for thousands of years. What's changed, though, is the technology. We now pump approximately 30 billion gallons of groundwater every day.
Manufacture of an average automobile, 350,000 liters. One microchip, 32 liters.
The farming community started tapping into our aquifers at a time when there really were not other demands on the resource. The way that the law works is that they're allowed to use limitless quantities. And then the added kicker is that the law said, if you don't use it, if you don't divert all of this water, you may lose your water right.
So with that scenario, it doesn't encourage conservation of water. I mean, why am I going to go ahead and quit pumping to save water and lose everything?
Ryan Schwaback, New Mexico farmer.
So then a guy like me who may want to quit pumping to quit depleting the aquifer, I have to keep pumping in order to keep my water rights.
When we pump water for such irrigation, some of it percolates back into the ground, which is called recharge or return flows. So long as we pump no more than what is recharged, we are using the groundwater sustainably. The problem is that we're pumping up to 15 times more water from the ground than is returning back into it, creating a global crisis.
One thing that most people don't know is that the world is desertifying very quickly. We are becoming a desert in many places.
Our soil is eroding, simply meaning that overgrazing, winds, and flooding damage the top layer of earth, essentially hardening it to the point that rainwater cannot easily soak into the ground. Our life source literally slips away from us, back into the ocean through sewers and rivers, draining the land of its moisture and life.
Dr. Michael Kravchuk, hydrologist, director NGO People and Water, recipient of the G7 Award for Democracy and Civil Society. As we dry out the land, it's changing from green to yellow, resulting in all the fresh water accumulating in the ocean.
Extreme weather, a world of hurricanes and violent storms over the ocean, while the interior land receives less and less rain, or violent, harsh storms that simply erode the land more.
The land surface weight is lightened, while the rise of water in the ocean increases the weight on the ocean floor. This can cause changes of the structure of the Earth's crust, which causes earthquakes and potentially tsunami-like waves, like the ones we experienced in 2004.
Deforestation is a major contributor to soil erosion. Tree roots absorb water and thus hold the watershed in place. When they leave the land, so does the water.
Vandana Shiva, physicist, ecologist, activist, author of Water Wars.
Because the forests that held the water have all been logged. There is no place where the water can be stored. The rain still comes and runs away as instant surface runoff.
Just what I feared. He's formed a gang, and they're whooping it up for a flash flood. They're rushing down the canyon. They've made a wall of water 20 feet high. Look out! No longer satisfied with flash floods, the gang is planning bigger and wetter floods. Junior's getting dangerous. He's getting tougher and bolder every day.
But groundwater pumping cannot alone be blamed for our desertification crisis.
Cities are growing and expanding. For the first time in human history, more people living in cities than in the countryside.
We have replaced permeable ground with hardscape, with roofs, with parking lots, with homes.
If it rains and the water doesn't hit the ground but hits the sidewalk or street instead, it can't soak into the ground and make trees. It just slides down the street back to the ocean and makes more clouds. This means that the ground gets really dry and the grass and trees die.
Clearly, there is much more unpaved than paved land in the world, but the effect is cumulative and should not be underestimated.
Worldwide, we are annually losing 750 billion cubic meters, and this urbanization started after World War II. So we can say we are at the halfway point, and in 50 years, there will likely be a collapse of the planet's water sources.
There is another problem with increased urbanization, which is our continued insistence to build housing for growing populations that demand more water than local watersheds can provide.
Dr. Peter Warshall, environmental practice consultant.
People in the housing development, and they make money by turning houses, and they're very large companies. So their goal is to avoid the water issue that might limit the number of houses they might have.
Instead of adapting our development to the available water supply of a region, we choose to force the world's water supply to adapt to our desired locations.
What dams do is change the hydrologic cycle. They provide water during those months when the natural flow patterns do not.
What's happened is that we built these huge hydro dams mainly to create hydropower and hydroelectricity. And when we've done that, we've done it in a very narrow framework, and we haven't thought about the fact that we're going to need water for other purposes.
In this quest to conquer nature, as some label it, we've constructed close to 50,000 large dams worldwide. But if we are headed towards desertification by allowing too much rainwater to run off into the sea, then is it not to our benefit to dam water and prevent it from reaching the sea?
Helen Saracinos, Dams Program Manager of River Alliance of Wisconsin.
One of the basic functions of rivers is to carry stuff from one place to another. And that stuff, which is really critical to the health of an entire watershed, it becomes completely and wholly interrupted when you build a dam.
Dammed rivers fail to carry such nutrients and minerals downstream through the watershed, resulting in more soil erosion, less percolation when it rains, more runoff, and thus an increase in the desertification problem.
When you trap water, it stops moving, and when it stops moving, it heats up because it's this nice, warm soup full of nutrients that are not making it downstream. But then those things die, and then they eat up oxygen. All of a sudden, you've got a major water quality problem.
A river is the lifeblood of an ecosystem, just like the veins and arteries bring blood to every part of our organism. When we have choked arteries, that's what's called a heart attack. A dam is the choking of the artery of the planet.
So we really have to face the crisis here, that what we were taught in school, that this finite amount of water could never run out, is technically true. But if you can't access it because you took it from an aquifer and you poured it into a desert to grow cotton, or you polluted it, it's of no use to us, and that's what we need to get into our heads. And there's nowhere to go in the world to get away from this. Rich people and people who live in water-rich countries will get away from it longer than people who are facing it now, but the world water crisis will face us all. But if there is going to be one single thing that is going to slam us into reality, it is going to be running out of water.
We see all sorts of fresh water in our lakes and say, well, you know, what's the problem? We've got lots of fresh water. Once you drain a lake, that's it. There is no more water. We have to start focusing in on what is the renewable supply, which comes through the hydrologic cycle. We are creating a situation where we have less and less of that renewable supply left. And with the help of water scientists, we have to really start to assess how much water we really do have to work with. What is that renewable supply, and trying to define it? That's the task at hand. We must be able to find out what the limits are and how to live within them.
The politics.
But instead of our governments coming together and saying we have a limited amount of time to come together and find the solution, what they've done is they've handed power over to big water companies who want to create a kind of water cartel.
Suez, Veolia, which used to be Vivendi, and RWE Thames. And these companies are all in the top 100 top corporations. I mean, the water division of Suez has 400,000 employees. I mean, try saying no to them if you're a little third world country, right?
So that one day, every single drop of fresh water in the world will be privately owned and controlled.
Up until the 1980s, really, if water was privatized, they were companies within a country. So France was mostly privatized, but the companies that then became the giants were just French companies delivering water locally.
Winona Howder, director, Food and Water Watch.
Water privatization in France, because of the multinationals that are so powerful there, and because of their long history there, is so ingrained that even the president of France wasn't able to stop it.
Danielle Mitterrand, widow of former French president François Mitterrand.
François, in a certain moment
of his term, was trapped within this economic dictatorship, and he could not nationalize the water companies because this is a very powerful system. This is a machine that has no soul.
And then in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher came to power, and the Thatcher Revolution came into effect, and she privatized all the water in Great Britain. And that's when these big companies decided that they could start going global. At the same time, the UN was beginning to explore the language of water as an economic good and a commodity. And the very first time was at a very important conference in Dublin in 1992, which for the first time named water as a good. So you get the Thatcher-Reagan market economy ideology growing over here. You've got the companies all ready to go because they've been delivering inside nation states. And now you've got the UN saying, okay, we're ready to start thinking about water differently. It's not a right. So it all kind of converged together. While the World Bank is created after the Second World War to bring financial stability and development to the developing world, and it's supposed to be pooled money from the wealthier countries to help develop the global south. However, what's happened is that the World Bank has hooked up with the three big water private service companies in Europe. They basically started to work their way into the developing world. And the World Bank would say, in exchange for debt relief, now we want you to privatize water.
Buenos Aires, Argentina, buyer, Suez. Puerto Rico, buyer, Veolia. Jakarta, Indonesia, buyer, RWE Thames. Santiago, Chile, buyer, Veolia.
The WTO comes in with rules that basically establish this in a new constitutional framework. It's run by what's called the Quad, which is the United States, Canada, the European Union, and Japan. And the Quad makes all the decisions. It's their corporations that set the agenda. They decide when the meetings are going to be held. And they had thousands of military police with, you know, the full riot gear and so on. And the farmers had a huge march. And the head of South Korean Farmers Union is a man named Lee Kyung-hai. And he came from a devastated community where people were killing themselves. He climbed up on this police barricade. He took a knife and stabbed himself in the heart. Rocked back and forth on top of this fence and fell. He died a couple of hours later in the hospital. And this became an enormously important symbol. These trade rules are not some dry academic thing on a piece of paper. These are rules that affect people's lives, and these are rules that are killing people.
We've heard the facts at this meeting. We've heard about the underachievement and the failures of privatization. And we know that ultimately these corporations aren't accountable to the communities that they serve. They're accountable to their shareholders. And nothing's going to change that.
Winona Howder.
People think that water privatization is just a problem in the global south and the developing world, but that's just simply not the case. We have the very same situation in the U.S.
New York, New York, Bayer, Suez. Chicago, Illinois, Bayer, Veolia. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Bayer, RWE, Thames. Las Vegas, Nevada, Bayer, Suez. New Orleans, Louisiana, Bayer, Veolia. Seattle, Washington, Bayer, RWE, Thames.
It's the very same story, whether it's in Atlanta, Georgia, or Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Riverside, California, Bayer, Suez. Grand Canyon, Arizona, Bayer, Veolia. Buffalo, New York, Bayer, RWE, Thames. Houston, Texas, Bayer, Suez. Tampa, Florida, Bayer, Veolia. Atlanta, Georgia, Bayer, Suez.
It was a big push at the time. Privatization was the word. Everybody wanted to privatize something.
Claire Muller, Atlanta City Council member.
And frankly, I'm not opposed to privatization. We privatize our recycling pickup, but this water was different. But we did sign a contract with United Water for 20 years for operation and maintenance of our water system.
Olivier Hodeman, Corporate Europe Observatory.
For these companies, when their name has been tarnished because of their malpractice and their mismanagement, it can be a big advantage to use another name. Suez often uses the name Ondeo, and very rarely the brand Suez is visible. And the same, of course, with Vivendi. Vivendi had gained a very bad reputation because of their records in failed privatization and mismanagement. And they were suddenly reinvented under this name Veolia, and a huge advertising budget was spent to create a positive feeling around this new brand name. Of course, advertising is a crucial factor in the way these companies are trying to save their image.
And almost immediately started having service problems, and citizens could not drink the water unless it had been boiled.
There are no clear-cut performance requirements and performance guarantees.
We did require in the contract that they take all of our 550 employees for labor reasons.
They usually slash the workforce, sometimes in half.
So they cut out about 200 employees, and that could have been part of the reason for the service delivery.
They couldn't find out where all the piping connections were. The workers themselves were the people that knew where things were.
The mayor at the time was Bill Campbell, and Suez gave him a $6,900 campaign contribution, but he wasn't running for office. A trip to Paris, where he and a female companion stayed in the best hotels and were wined and dined.
Although two of the three water corporate giants are based in France, and French water has been privatized since the time of Napoleon, a small percentage of French regions have maintained their own water distribution through their city councils. The city of Grenoble managed its own water for over a century, providing good quality water at low prices to consumers.
Raymond Avillier, citizen leader against Suez.
Suez.
The mayor of Grenoble chose to privatize our water to Léonani Stézo Suez. All the public services are much cheaper than the privatized services.
There hasn't been one example in the world where there hasn't been a hike in the water rates.
Il n'y avait aucune raison.
There was not any logical reason to privatize this service that was working so well. His decision was in return for personal profit. They bought the mayor of Grenoble.
I'm not a big fan of government controlling a lot of stuff. I've been in government. I've worked in the federal government, I worked in state government, I worked in local government, and I see an extraordinary amount of corruption.
Rick Davidage, former director of water of Alaska under Ronald Reagan, current CEO of World Water Bulk Sales and Exporter, a.k.a. Alaska Water Czar.
Right now, we have a number of state senators that have just been indicted in Alaska for corruption. dealing with the oil industry. But what was the amount of corruption? A few thousand dollars. It's not the money, it's the power.
Mexico City.
Not many people know that prior to being president, Vicente Fox was the general manager for Coca-Cola in Latin America. So Coca-Cola received some of the largest water concessions in Mexico during the Fox administration.
And this is something that really needs to be opened up for serious debate. People do not realize the extent to which there is a direct giveaway on the part of governments of water resources and services to industries locating in their jurisdiction.
Harry Ott, Director, Global Environmental Assurance, Coca-Cola Enterprises.
Well, I want to be very clear about the situation in Mexico that President Vicente Fox has given us no special favors on water issues or anything else along that line.
The largest water concession given by the government in the whole country was to a Coca-Cola bottling plant. It takes as much water as it wants. You could say that Coca-Cola ruled Mexico.
If you really look at the controversy of whether water should be owned privately or water should be owned publicly, I see abuses on both sides. When water is only owned by the government, you have an opportunity for abuse. When water is jointly owned by someone who has a capital interest, a private interest, a profit interest, and government, you have a partnership that tends to balance those things out.
The new face of colonialism comes in the form of Coca-Cola. You walk anywhere in Africa and it's Coca-Cola water. You cannot get anything but, you cannot drink the water out of the tap. You can't even find purifiers. You are an absolute slave to this company.
Daniel Vermeer, Director, Global Water Partnerships, Coca-Cola Enterprises.
Dasani is not meant to be a substitute for municipal supply. So we are absolutely in support of robust, comprehensible, and equitable water and sanitation systems.
We've redefined how consumers get hydrated. Coca-Cola's 2000 annual report. Dr. Wangari Maathai, Nobel Peace Prize winner.
In this country, you have to pay more for this water than you pay for the same amount of Coca-Cola. So that's something.
Dasani is in plastic bottles, and Coca-Cola are in glass bottles. Now, when you look at the price difference, what you're looking at is that the cost of producing those bottles is much higher. We have looked at, in the past, bottling Dasani in the glass, but the plastic package is becoming very popular now, and what we're looking at is what the customers want. As you look at new ways to develop business, you look at also what the customer wants and needs are. The situation with the cost of Dasani is more about the packaging. And also, plastic bottles are taxed at a higher rate than glass bottles.
I think Wall Street per se understands in 50 years this is the commodity to be invested in. There's a sunset out there. There's a horizon out there that's coming closer and closer for oil, but not for water.
There are at least a dozen publicly traded water indexes that deal only with water, trading it on the open stock market. 5 years ago, this didn't exist. Now it's just simply exploding.
It takes two players to really make the corruption happen. First of all, we have corporations who are often greedy, but corporations are not social service agencies. They're there to make a profit. And what happens too often is that the water hunters are able to come in and either the government is corrupt or the laws are not sufficient to protect the water resources.
As a water hunter, you just go out and you try to find a water source. It's not going to cost you a lot of money to clean up. The problem is getting it and holding on to it. Canada had 12 contracts for bulk export of water, and arbitrarily, with the change of government in British Columbia, canceled those contracts. When you have a change in government, the previous government's commitments are subject to renegotiation, and that's just the way it is. So when you're looking at water owned by someone else that you have to get a contract with, that's not a secure commodity anymore. The only way to have a secure commodity is to create it yourself by desalinization.
Many do not see the harm in depending on desalination for our future water needs.
And suddenly, many countries in the world are looking to desal and building new desal plants as the alternative, and this is going to save them.
But to do that, we require a great deal of fossil fuels and burning of fossil fuels, which contributes to global warming, which in turn contributes to the climate change problem in general. In order to address one problem, we end up creating a new problem.
We already have an energy shortage. Where are we going to get the energy to use desalination? And a lot of corporations are saying nuclear technologies. Well, nuclear technologies are really not viable. We have no current plan to deal with nuclear waste.
You know, it's no different from saying to ourselves that we're going to go into space after making a mess out of this planet. We go into Mars, we relocate there, or we colonize space itself and colonize another planet. And having made a mess out of our own situation, having failed to live up to our own responsibilities in relationship to nature, we then move on to destroy another piece of nature and leave the mess behind.
Jack Symes, External Coordination Manager, Yuma, Arizona Bureau of Reclamation and Desalination Plant.
The fact that there aren't more plants in the world is because it's a cost factor.
Only rich countries or the World Bank or big corporations or a combination of all three are going to be able to afford to build desalination plants.
But even on the slim chance that technology can advance quickly enough, that the energy costs and needs lower enough to make a global desalination solution possible, the question still remains, why? Why forfeit the water we already currently have? Why freely give it to others only so they can sell it back to us at whatever cost the demand allows?
When you have communities that are looking to extend their water supplies, they'll pay what they feel the value of that supply is worth.
There are 87 corporations now building desalination plants, and the biggest water company of all is General Electric, followed by Procter & Gamble and Dow Chemicals getting into it. These are all companies that have seen the writing on the wall. And the writing on the wall is that water is the hottest property out there.
I think you can add a 15% on that. I think if 15% is responsible, some investors will require 30. And if you can't offer 30, they're not interested in investing.
What we actually have is that these big corporations are going to profit from dirty water. So they don't want to see the pollutants not going into the water in the first place. They want to have a model where they can step in and provide very expensive technologies to clean up pollution after it occurs.
I wondered when I looked at the UN Millennium Goals why they didn't include goals around pollution and cracking down on the fact that if you can't use the rivers and lakes in your area, then you're forced to mine groundwater. Well, it's as clear as a bell to me now. It's because they're raking in the money. Who's going to own that water when General Electric has it to clean? Does it pass through them but still belong to the public? I don't think so.
So it becomes a product that is a result of your process, and then you own it.
Who ends up owning these desal plants? Because if these desal plants are in private hands or even in government hands, because after all, water is the source of life. These desal plants are the way in which we get access to water. Then those desal plants and who owns them ends up controlling our lives.
Bottom line, water is a good investment, period. Any place in the world. How much do you pay for your bottle of water? You can fill that bottle of water at the tap for practically nothing. And the difference between what's in the bottle and what's in the tap is, in most cases, insignificant.
Nestle, spokesperson.
You know, we do not advocate bottled water over tap water. You know, consumers generally buy bottled water because of convenience, because of access. I wouldn't say that it's healthier. It is a healthy alternative.
New Haven, Wisconsin. Nestle, a.k.a. Perrier, proposes a bottling plant.
Because of the world water scarcity, the Great Lakes have been perceived to be a target.
We are concerned about our wetlands. And actually, my thought was, it's our water. They don't have a right to take it, which wasn't correct.
In our legal framework, corporations have the same rights as citizens. And so we see Nestle having the ability to go in and pump.
John Steinhaus, Vice President, Waterkeepers of Wisconsin.